The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're about to have another conversation with New York Times columnist Charles Blow. His latest column that we're talking about is called The Great Evil, that appeared in Saturday, July 23rd, New York Times. An interesting piece, and Charles, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
I'm happy to be here.
Charles, this is I like the way you began this. At first, we thought maybe it was you were going to do a movie review of The Fifth Element, which is an old movie. Old, relatively.
It's an old movie. Well, now you're aging me.
1997, as you point out in your article.
But right.
So before we start, before you started thinking about how many white folks are moving towards the Republican Party, did the movie do something to you to make this come about? I mean, did you see the movie and then go, oh, have this epiphany?
Well, okay, so I'm like a closet, like, sci-fi B-movie freak. So I've probably seen this movie 1,000 times and can recite you, like, line for line from this movie. So you know, I kept trying to think of, like, about how this thing that should had not been a problem had become a problem, and it was huge, and it was hurling towards us. And, you know, the great evil, which is the big ball of fire in the movie, mm-hmm. kept coming to mind. And so I thought, oh, that's an interesting parallel. And when I just thought about the movie and kind of the characters in the movie and the characters that we have in D.C., I found that there were even more parallels, so I thought, huh, that's an interesting way to deal with this, because there was quite a lot of serious things that had already been written, and I thought quite good things, but it was a way for me to get into it and talk to people about it, relate it, help them to relate to it.
I like the literary parallels here that you're making, but I'm going to come back to the parallels, but what you're talking about actually is a really interesting phenomenon. I mean, we've talked a lot in the show about the election that took place 2 years ago, and that it was a really watershed election in that, not besides the fact that we elected an African-American as president, but in that 43% of white Americans voted for Barack Obama, voted for a mm-hmm. black man to become president of the United States of America. Mm-hmm. And that kind of set an interesting divide in America, which you're kind of in some ways going back to see what has happened to that divide.
Well, in a way, because in 2008, the Democrats enjoyed tremendous party affiliation advantages over Republicans. And that was, in general, across the board, it was less among whites, as is historically the truth, but it was also high there. But what I cited in this column was a Pew Research poll that looked at the time from 2008 to 2011, and what they found was a real shift among white voters towards Republican Party affiliation. There was no corresponding shift among blacks. There was there were something like a 2-point change from like 6 to 8 or something like that of party affiliation. This includes people who consider themselves independent but lean towards Republican. So it was 2% gain. Among Hispanics, there was a 6% drop. But among whites, there was a rise, and specifically on some core demographic groups like the poor, there was a 10% jump. Young people, another 10% jump. The less educated was an 8% jump. It was striking at how big the change had been in this one group of people.
What do you attribute this to? Is it race? I mean, is it the great divide in America? Is that what it is?
I think that part of it would have to take race into account. there's no way to get around it, because when you look at the other groups, there is no corresponding movement. There are different things that different people care about, but if you look at economic issues, you would think that that Democratic policies would more favor people who are poor, people who are less well-educated. You would think that they would actually gain among that group, and that if you saw a rise in Republican Party affiliation, it would probably be among the group that they seem to care the most about most recently, is the people who are more well-off. Well, that wasn't the case. There was only a 2 percentage point change in people making, among whites, and people making $75,000 or more. The big jump came among those who were making the least. So there's no way to divorce race from that that calculation.
I wonder, someone has said to me in a conversation recently, actually it's Sherrilyn Ifill, who's a professor of law, who's the first cousin of Gwen Ifill, who's been a guest on the show many times, is an old friend. She said when she analyzes what happens with votes like this and in situations like this, that perhaps the problem was that so many white voters who voted, who were poor, who voted for Obama in the beginning, because they believed in hope and change, and because the economy wasn't his first attack in putting people back to work and saving people's homes, that that might play into this kind of very squishy support for President Barack Obama that is among working-class white people.
I mean, the economy is definitely part of it. Whoever is in charge, when the economy is sour, generally gets the backlash of people who are unhappy with the way things are going. So that is definitely part of it. But I think it would be a miscalculation to say that, you know, many of the people who voted for him are the ones who are moving away. First of all, a lot of people did not vote for him. Like you pointed out at the beginning of the show, it's less than 50% of whites voted for Barack Obama. The support there was already kind of squishy. The support there among whites for any Democratic presidential nominee is already kind of suppressed. Even if the Democrats enjoy a party ID advantage. So part of it is just, you know, reaction to him. Part of it is reaction to Democrats. And part of it is an economic reaction that things have not gotten better for people in their daily lives.
I wonder when you look at these things, I was thinking about the piece you wrote a couple of weeks back on poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And this to me really ties. I mean, them that's not shall lose after James Baldwin.
Mm-hmm.
And this always been this divide. I read that article and I thought about the Poor People's Campaign in 1968 and Martin Luther King's effort to bring together poor whites, poor blacks, Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, Native people into one coalition to fight against poverty and for economic rights. And it actually worked for a short period of Resurrection City. And I remember, well, I was in the middle of it. But I wonder what that correlation means to you about then and now, and why this divide is so deep.
Well, there are two ways to look at this. First, I mean, what a lot of people like to focus on when they look at low-income voters, and particularly those who vote for people who promote policies that seem to be more directed toward insulating wealth rather than alleviating poverty, is why would you vote against your interest? And there are a couple of ways to look at that. One is that people across the political spectrum vote against their interest. These lower wage, lower in some cases, lower income whites vote against their economic interest. There are blacks, many, many, many blacks, who vote against their moral interest. If you look at where they stand on moral issues, they're much more aligned with Republican philosophy than it is with Democratic philosophy, which is a lot more liberal, but they vote for their economic interest and against Democrats get people to focus on economic issues, you'd probably be able to hold a poor coalition together. If Republicans could get people to focus simply on their religious and moral issues, they'd have a bigger coalition. But people just don't break that way. They tend to choose whether or not they're voting on faith or on finance and split.
This is a very tough, this is not in your piece, and I'm just asking this because your thoughts. It's a very tough, tricky line and question to ask. Is there a correlation for you as you look at these numbers and that you create and talk about your graphs? Is there a correlation between conservatism in America and race?
Well, absolutely. I mean, and that goes back quite a ways. There are groups that are very conservative. Blacks are very conservative. Evangelical Christians are very conservative, who are mostly white. But it kind of cuts across. Hispanics tend to be, on the whole, a bit less conservative than blacks, but more conservative than whites on the whole, because you have two different kind of competing groups of whites. There are the kind of liberal big city whites, and then there are the rest of white America, which is a bit more religious, a bit more conservative. So it kind of cuts across in a way.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not monolithic the way that we kind of like to think about it.
Yeah, the monoliths are always dangerous to kind of play with, I think, anywhere we go. But when you write, I mean, you're a man who grew up in the South.
Right.
Right? So you came through a lot. That's a story for another day. But you came through a lot to get to where you are. And you've also written some things that are not critical of so much as questioning and positing questions about where the president is taking the country, what he may be missing.
Well, I think that there's there are a lot of poor people in the country who do not get mentioned often enough, whose considerations are not taken into account because they do not have a voice. They do not have an army of lobbyists. They do not, and this is a bit of a knock, do not vote in the numbers that we would like to have them. They do not stay abreast of all the news because they're trying to keep their heads above water and pay the bills and keep food on the table. But there are vast swatches of these people who seem to get left out of the debate or to be sacrificed when someone has to be sacrificed. When the other people who are held safe are the wealthy on the one hand, and the more well-to-do, stable union kinds of workers on the left. And so those two groups have champions, and there seems to be less of a willingness to champion the rights of the people who do not have that kind of a voice. And so there are times when I am a little bit exercised about that, because I come from one of those backgrounds. I come from one of those families where people, you're desperately poor, and there's no one looking out for your best interest. And even in this debt debate, the discussions kept kind of hinting at, and we still may get, trillions of dollars in cuts, and those will most directly and most immediately affect the least able to absorb such a shock. And they are the ones who will be sacrificed.
And it seems always that way. I mean, the piece you wrote last week, They Too Sing America, where you looked at the jobs of the future, and we tout the jobs of the future all the time about where they're going to be, but you very clearly indicated the equally high percentage of jobs coming up: home health aides, food prep workers, home care workers, retail salespeople, where the remuneration will be very low, as opposed to this kind of view of the futuristic jobs as being high-paying.
Absolutely, and we're constantly told, you know, that now a college degree may not be enough. We're constantly told that you have to go into some technical field if you want to have any sort of job security, that you have to, you know, I mentioned in that column about what they call STEM workers.
Right.
These are the, you know, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, that those are the fields of the future, and if you want job security, you have to have those. But ironically, those are the jobs that are most easily outsourced. There, half of the top 30 job categories that will see the most growth are low-income jobs that you cannot outsource. You cannot outsource to China somebody to come in and check on your grandmother. You cannot outsource to India someone to prepare your food. These are things that you have to do here in America. Those jobs are not going away. It's just that those people do not have people who are advocating on their behalf. Those, in many cases, these are job categories that do not have union representation. They are no one is speaking up for them. They are on their own, but they are a huge part of not only the present workforce, but will be a huge part of the future workforce. And in fact, of that list of 30, 7 out of the 10 fastest growing job categories were job categories that had low or very low in wages.
So, and what I thought about in the terms of what you just wrote in your latest piece last Saturday, The Great Evil, that, I mean, to me there's a correlation here. And the correlation for me is, I'll see what you think, is that, I mean, that people who are terrified about their future, these jobs that are growing, if you are white or black or Latino or whoever you are, and you see that's your future, well, you may not vote, or you, and if you tie that into race, you may switch and go, nobody's taking care of me, and these guys over here at least seem patriotic enough that they're going to whistle my tune and not forget me. The Mangalores from the movie.
Exactly. but that may be part of it. And part of it is that people who are working these really hard jobs that you work with your body and not just with your mind, you don't sit in air conditioning, you're not pushing papers, you don't have the radio on in the background, you're not watching television out of the corner of your eye, may not simply be as tuned in to the issue. So you can kind of catch a bumper sticker phrase, I don't want to raise anybody's taxes, and you don't realize that they're talking about not raising taxes on people who are making $250,000 or more. And in fact, they're not even talking about the first $250,000. They're just talking about the money that they make in addition to the $250,000 and only 3% of that. That's what the eliminating the Bush tax cuts would do. It's nothing. But because it comes across as a bumper sticker, because you cannot tune in, because you're part of the working poor, because you may have had to make a choice that month or that year between whether or not you kept the internet service going or whether or not you kept the food coming in the house, you're not sitting in front of a computer all night doing the things that I do, which is reading news all day. So part of it may be they whistle your tune. Part of it is that people just cannot connect deeply enough and long enough in order to be able to, you know, kind of dig down into the issues the way many of us who have cushier jobs and cushier lifestyles can do. It's a sad fact. And so it's easier to manipulate people who, when they don't have enough time to engage, than it is to manipulate someone who has the time, energy, and know-how to get information that they need and to process that information.
So I, and as you paint the picture of the from the movie, I'm just laughing is the way you wrote it, about the great evil and the industrialist as a vile, twisted character who sees destruction as a jobs program.
Right.
It turns out he doesn't even like the Mangalores, the people who he's got to fight for him. How does that translate to you to the world we live in now?
Well, I genuinely believe that there's a parallel there. You know, people who have painted themselves as advocates of things or in the corner of the right, who I don't think in general are necessarily all that enthusiastic about the things that happen on the ground level of the right, but they use the energy that they can create there to advance policies that insulate their wealth. And in fact, you see that all across the board. You see people pretending to be, you know, I'm every, you know, the everybody, every person, I'm just like you. Well, all of those people who keep saying that they're just like you are now multimillionaires, and, you know, Gingrich is flying around on private jets and has, you know, a $500,000 credit lines at Tiffany's. But but somehow they're able to trick the mind into saying, people's mind is saying, oh, I'm just like you, I'm everybody, and then this guy in the White House is the elitist, or these big city liberals are the elitist. But what they're doing is, in a way, is kind of figuring out ways to insulate the wealth that they have and use people who do not have it to advance that cause.
So I'm interested to see where you take this in coming weeks. As you bring us your Saturday thoughts.
Okay.
I really am. And I look forward to a long conversation about this with you sometime in the very near future. It's been fascinating to watch your column grow and where it's taking us. Or it's
thank
taking you.
You. No, thank you.
We're talking with Charles M. Blow. Charles M. Blow, of course, is the visual op-ed columnist for The Sun. For the New York Times, it appears every Saturday in the Times, and you can link to it from our website, steinershow.org. And once again, Charles M. Blow, it's been a real pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.